Hello, and thank you for joining us for this MedCast series titled Untapped Potentials, Exploring Overlooked Therapies for Type 2 Diabetes. I'm Dhiren Patel, a clinical pharmacist and an adjunct associate professor of pharmacy practice at the Mass College of Pharmacy in Boston, Massachusetts.
I'm Bob Bush. I'm a practicing endocrinologist and director of clinical research at the Albany Medical Center Endocrine Group in Albany, New York.
In this episode, we will examine some less used therapies in type 2 diabetes and discuss why we need to give them a second look and how they could be a viable treatment option for many patients with type 2 diabetes. To discuss more of this, we are joined by Dr. Tara Dahl, a primary care physician and lipidologist in Delafield, Wisconsin, who focuses on the prevention of heart disease and diabetes. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Dahl.
Thank you for having me.
So Dr. Dahl, we know that there's a lot of new agents that are available when it comes to type 2 diabetes. Could you give us some reasons to maybe think about some of the other therapies that have been available for some times that haven't received much attention? You know, we hear a lot, you know, in the news about GLPs and SGLT2 inhibitors, but we have a lot of agents that we've kind of grown up with that still have a lot of, you know, utility and they're, you know, excellent tools for the toolbox. So if you could comment on some of those medications.
Sure. I think the biggest message that was awesome about having cardiology and endocrinologists join together and the forces against diabetes has really made a difference with some of the newer drugs, just bringing attention to the fact cardiovascular disease matters when we talk about diabetes. I think that there's a couple medications that I still definitely utilize, even though they're older drugs. Quick-release bromocriptine, pioglitazone are probably the two therapies that I would reach for most often out of the older drugs. I don't even know if I've ever prescribed a sulfonylurea. I've been in medicine 30 years, but that's never really been on my list of medications I use regularly. So I don't know that I continue to use that. I think it's starting to fall a little bit more out of favor, except unless we need, there's issues related to cost. Obviously, the new drugs are very expensive and not available to everybody. So some of those other therapies can be helpful. And colesevelam is another medication that I might use, especially if there's lipid-related issues that I'm trying to address as well.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Dr. Bush, your thoughts on some of the older agents?
So we're very spoiled with our practice in the state capital in Albany. So GLP, SGLT2 are widely covered as branded drugs. But like you, I do, you know, have needs for some of these other drugs if patients don't have great drug plans or to supplement what they're on, or if they can't tolerate it. If you have, you know, GI ill effects for GLP or pancreatitis and you can't be on an SGLT2 because of recurrent yeast infections, there's a need for some of the other meds. Like you, I take great pride that I don't use sulfonylurea and had no other additional benefit. And as like you, as you mentioned, TZDs do have some other benefits, lipid benefits and others, as well as bromocriptine has other benefits. DPP-4s are very safe. They're effective, but they don't have the cardiac benefit. But those are the other players. But using bile acid sequestrants and TZDs and maybe some bromocriptine, I'm very much like what you do.
Excellent. So I guess you guys both mentioned bromocriptine. It's one that our viewers might not know a lot about. So Dr. Dahl, could you talk a little bit about kind of bromocriptine, you know, the background of it and kind of how it fits into your practice?
Sure. So I just want to specify that when I mention bromocriptine, I'm not talking about the bromocriptine that's used for Parkinson's, hyperprolactinemia and other therapeutic uses. I'm talking specifically about quick release bromocriptine, which was released almost, it was probably 14 or 15 years ago. I think I was one of the first people excited about it, but it's a very different formulation that allows for a quick release, and it's a dopamine agonist. So it is very useful in the setting of patients that have diabetes. That's what it's indicated for, but it's also actually very useful in those patients, even the insulin resistant pre-diabetic population, because it's another medication that doesn't cause hypoglycemia. It's weight neutral. It has a lot of lipid related benefits, and it really helps address some of the abnormal mechanisms happening in the brain in the setting of diabetes, insulin resistance, and other parts of that spectrum. So I think that it still plays a role for me and in those patients. The other thing is I've got patients with diabetes and cardiovascular disease that I need to find agents for, and they don't need weight loss. And the problem is, even though the GLP-1 agonists and SGLT2s are excellent therapies and we use them in all kinds of patients, some of my patients are actually losing too much weight. And we need to also be thinking about what options can we use that are safe cardiovascularly. They might have some benefits in the cardiovascular space as far as reducing cardiovascular events, but also not necessarily ones that would be causing significant weight loss. And as Dr. Bush brought up, I don't think I've ever seen male yeast infections until we started using SGLT2 inhibitors. And I've had a handful of patients, especially if somebody's uncircumcised or they have other factors that just make them a little bit more susceptible. And that has become a major issue for people. So we do have to have, you know, other agents. And that's where, when I have patients with cardiovascular risk, lipid-related issues, elevated heart rate, blood pressure issues, sort of that, what we would consider almost that metabolic syndrome patient, I think that's the kind of patient that I really think about utilizing quick-release bromocriptine for, because it's very safe, it's very effective, and it really is very complementary to what we're doing with the GLP-1 agonists. I've actually been able to get a number of patients off insulin by using GLP-1 agonists in combination with quick-release bromocriptine.
In terms of kind of, you know, you mentioned some of the safety, you know, well-tolerated. Talk to us a little bit about the efficacy, and you talk kind of, we're going in that direction with some of the combination approach use that you have, but what do you typically see in your patient population?
So I'm not necessarily focusing on A1C reductions, but of course you get A1C reduction. It's indicated for reduction of A1C, but I'm thinking a bit more about the pathophysiology of diabetes and trying to tap into various mechanisms that are driving that, especially as they impact the cardiovascular system. So I'm seeing people with elevated triglycerides, with elevated heart rate. We're looking at, do we add a second or third hypertensive medication in these patients? Because what happens is, so many of these people with diabetes, they have just a complex metabolic soup of mess. It's a mess. It's just a mess across the board. And I've found that addressing that at a root cause, you know, thinking about the root cause of the problem, which so often isn't really focused on glucose, is focused on the underlying pathophysiology of the disease state, which by the time we see an A1C of 6.5, even an A1C of 6, we've already got a significant amount of beta cell dysfunction. And so we've got to be thinking about, what can we do to preserve that beta cell function to prevent further, worsening of insulin resistance, and how can we really kind of get them to a better place with that? So it really has great utility in that kind of patient population when they've got this revved up sympathetic nervous system, which so many of them do.
No, that's helpful. Thank you. And so based on the clinical data that you've seen and that's available, you alluded to one of these points already, but should it be used as monotherapy or combination add-on?
So I use it as monotherapy. Sometimes I've used it as a first line agent. Usually I try metformin just because of the cost concerns, but usually my next step, if I have an opportunity in that patient that is, as I just mentioned, kind of complex metabolic syndrome kind of patient, that would be something I would definitely consider if there wasn't a specific indication for an SGLT2 or a GLP-1 agonist first. So I've used it as monotherapy. I've used it as add-on therapy with just about any kind of patient. I mean, I use it in patients who are already on insulin and people who are on metformin, who are on, honestly, SGLT2s, GLP-1 agonists. It really can be used in any of those settings. I think when I teach about diabetes and kind of when to use these, it's really important that people understand how to use it. And I think that's something that, because it's not as widely understood, it's really important to understand that, because it's a dopamine agonist, but what it needs to do is really mimic the natural circadian rhythm that would happen in a patient that doesn't have diabetes. Because in the normal setting, we would normally, when we wake up in the morning and our eye sees the light, our hypothalamus releases dopamine. We get this surge, and that has an impact on all of these systems we're talking about throughout the course of the day. In people with diabetes, insulin resistance, pre-diabetes, that whole spectrum, they lose that dopamine surge. So when they wake up in the morning, they've got this flat line, no surge of dopamine, and that really has adverse effects down the road in increase in free fatty acids, which increases triglycerides, increase in heart rate. I mean, all the things we see with diabetes. So the whole purpose of using something like quick-release bromocriptine is to be able to reestablish that normal sort of release of dopamine that you would see in a patient that doesn't have the pathophysiology of diabetes in the process of happening. So it really resets that essentially that broken hypothalamic clock that's not releasing dopamine as it should. It's sort of reestablishing that. And that really has made a huge difference in being able to see benefits throughout the course of the day. I mean, the nice thing about quick-release bromocriptine is it's out of the body usually within 4 hours just because of how quickly it's in the system. But the effect on postprandial glucose in particular continues throughout the 24 hours. Once you reset that clock in the morning, everything seems to improve throughout the course of the day. And they've seen that in the clinical studies. The postprandial glucose reductions when quick-release bromocriptine is added are seen long after the drug is out of the system. So it's really, I think that that's a neat mechanism. And again, because I do lipids, I'm looking at trying to address hypertriglyceridemia and other issues. And I rarely, if ever, you know, really reach for the lipid drugs for high triglycerides. I think more about how do I fix the underlying root cause, which is almost always insulin resistance, prediabetes, or diabetes that has either not been picked up on previously or is somehow lingering in the patient. We have to find it in a way other than sometimes an A1C.
That's super helpful, and appreciate you sharing that detail because, again, you know, it's therapies that, you know, if you haven't used it, you kind of want to figure out where it fits into that toolbox. And so those clinical pearls and those use cases were really helpful. Dr. Bush, anything else to add on the topic of bromocriptine?
So how do you titrate that? I remember when it first came out, you know, it was 1 to 2 pills in the beginning. And then how do you titrate that up? And when do you stop?
I've kind of learned by trial and error what works best. So I know that the company, you know, had releases information about how we should be dosing it. And the clinical trials were obviously done this way. So they would use a 0.8 milligram pill. It's one you take within 2 hours of waking. And of course, that's a very, very critical, important fact. I tell patients that. I put it on the bottle. I tell them you miss the therapy. You don't want to take it later in the day. But it's something that what I do is I use the 0.8, so the one pill in the morning for at least a week, if not two. Usually side effects that people experience with this one tend to occur in that first month, maybe as long as 6 weeks. And what I found is if I push it too fast in some people, they have more side effects. So if I've got a patient starting, they might experience a little nausea, maybe some headaches, sometimes post-lunch headaches I've seen a little bit more commonly. If it's bothering them enough to affect their quality of life, I'm not going to have them a week later push it to 2 and then push it to 3 the next week and then push it to 4. I mean, it's available up to 6 pills a day, which you would take all at once in the morning. In my clinical experience using a lot of it, and I started using it again like 14, 15 years ago, I found that when I went beyond 4, I actually started to see less benefit on labs and I started to pull back a little bit. So I rarely, if ever, give people more than the 4 pill dose, which is 3.6, I believe, if I'm doing the math right. And what I do is I go very slow and I tell the patient, if it takes you 2 to 3 weeks on just 1 or 2 pills in the morning, that's okay. Because I'd rather get them through whatever side effects they're experiencing. So they sort of get to the point where they're not having side effects and we see more efficacy. So I want them to hang in there. And I do that with other medications too that have more side effects. But specifically with this one, when you even look at the clinical trials and the incidence of side effects, you see this big bump in the first month of use, and especially with titration of the drug. But then as 4 to 5 weeks go out, that really slows down dramatically and it goes away. So I go slow. I go slower than usually is promoted. And I don't go up beyond 4 in the vast majority of patients. Many of them, 2 or 3 is sometimes all I will end up giving them because they have such good results from just that. So it's really 2 to 4, depending on the patient and probably the nature of the diabetes, what I'm trying to do with it. I might push it a little bit higher in somebody. I'm trying to taper off insulin, but I might, you know, use it in lower doses in somebody that doesn't need quite as much. And I think weight neutral is actually a good thing. I mean, it's nice to have something that could be added to something else that's being utilized that either has weight loss or weight neutrality, depending on what's needed for the patient, which obviously we have a lot of different patient populations. So we have to be thinking through that.
Yeah, and even though it lowers postprandial, it's not a secretagogue. So as you said, it doesn't cause hypoglycemia unless, of course, you're tapering the insulin itself.
Right, right.
That's really helpful.
I hear that other people don't use sulfonylureas anymore either. I feel like they wouldn't have made it to the market if we had to go through the same criteria today.
So. No, that's a great point. And I think you both talked about it. And so I won't ask that question about kind of where sulfonylureas fall in your kind of algorithms and within the guidelines. But could you talk to us a little bit about kind of TZDs? You mentioned pioglitazone, DPP-4 inhibitors, if they do get utilized, and would love both of your guys' thoughts on that. Dr. Dahl?
Sure. So when it comes to TZDs, I'm a lipid person. So I love the data on pioglitazone showing, I do advanced lipid testing in everybody. So the reduction in LDL particle concentration, small dense LDL, ApoB, is beneficial, as well as the reduction in triglycerides that we see with pioglitazone. It's very interesting because rosiglitazone, which had a lot of press about adverse cardiovascular events, had very different lipid effects. It actually, pioglitazone lowers triglycerides, rosiglitazone raised triglycerides. There was sort of, and the effect on LDL particles was, rosiglitazone was increasing it. So I think even within the class of TZDs, they're not the same. When I'm talking about using a TZD, I'm only using pioglitazone based on that data. There's also some interesting data. I think it was called the IRIS study, where they looked at patients that didn't have diabetes, but that had previous stroke or TIA, which is an interesting patient population that's important to be considering. And that data showed, again, people without even any diabetes who were randomized to pioglitazone had a really impressive reduction in subsequent strokes and other cardiovascular events. So that seems to be a particular niche for pioglitazone. Of course, we avoid it in patients that have CHF or high risk or, uncontrolled cardiovascular issues that may, CHF might be an issue of concern, because we know that in all the studies, despite the benefits, there is an increase in heart failure hospitalization with pioglitazone, not an increase in death, but an increase in hospitalization for that. So it's something, that's not the right patient, but these other patients, potentially a patient with previous stroke, TIA, might be a real appropriate patient to consider pioglitazone in. I also have used it quite a bit in the thin PCOS population with insulin resistance and issues like that. I've used pioglitazone in that setting as well. And again, people that have lipid-related issues that I think the benefits would be helpful. So that's where I'm using, pioglitazone still to some extent. It's also inexpensive, and that's helpful to reach for an inexpensive drug, because we can't get everybody on some of these medications. They're over $1,000 a month. It just doesn't work for every patient. And so we need to have those other options.
No, that's really helpful. And I always say the best drug is the one that the patient can afford and actually take, right? So the guidelines can tell you all that they want, but at the end of the day, you have reality, you have that patient in front of you, and it's whatever they can afford and it works best for their patient. Dr. Bush, what are some of the other benefits of including these in your regimen, some of these other therapies?
So exactly what you meant with pioglitazone. If I see someone come in on a fibric acid, goodbye fibric acid, hello pioglitazone if they have diabetes, because it has that same effect of lowering triglycerides, raise HDL, when you said about the particle number. Also, the niche for stroke, SGLT2s may lower cardiac death and lower heart failure, but they don't lower stroke. So the stroke lowering in the IRIS trial and in proactive trial that was the first cardiac study. In fact, PIO would have had the indication to lower heart disease before any of the other drugs, except they included peripheral vascular disease that PIO did not lower, and that was unfortunately one of the outcomes in proactive. And all the things you highlighted, but a lot of your colleagues and my colleagues don't use PIO anymore. And as you also mentioned, ROSI is what led to all the cardiovascular outcome trials to be done. So Right. Fortunately, because of ROSI's potential adverse effect, that's why all those trials were done with the other drugs. But PIO is still a big player, and because it's inexpensive, we use it quite a bit, other than the patient. I sometimes do BNP levels in my patients when I'm starting PIO, just to be sure that I'm not setting off occult heart failure. Do you do that?
I'm a biomarker queen, so I'm always looking at labs and advanced labs, and I think BNP can be very helpful. I mean, I even use it to try to pick up early sleep apnea, hypertension issues. I mean, I use it for a lot of reasons beyond even just looking at heart failure, but absolutely. And you're going to be more cautious. It's not contraindicated in somebody with a mild case of heart failure, but you have to be careful. I mean, it's just something that when you've got other options, it's harder to to hear, you know, to use that. But I love to hear too that you're thinking about stopping fibrates. I don't really use fibrates except in certain type 3 dyslipoproteinemia or certain genetic issues that might affect lipids and remnant particles that fibrates might have a role in. But I rarely, if ever, use them because they don't lower ApoB and LDL particles. And that's what I care about more than the other lipid effects. And I think the data was, you know, in more adverse in certain patient populations. So I like your approach. I do exactly what you do.
Yeah. And the edema issue with Pio, if you don't titrate it up too much, if you get rid of some of the other edemogenic drugs like a gabapentin or amlodipine, and also SGLT2s offset some of that of edema because of its osmotic diuresis. So if the patient can be on an SGLT2, I like that combination, as well as the cardiac benefit for the SGLT2 is different than the cardiac benefit that Pio might have.
Awesome. Well, thank you guys both for joining this MedCast episode and sharing your remarks.
Thank you for having me.
So it was great to have Dr. Tara Dahl join us and kind of talk about, you know, bromocriptine. I like the point that she makes about making sure people are thinking it's not the actual delayed release bromocriptine and it's the quick onset. And we also talked about some of the other therapies, you know, in the toolbox. And so if you could just kind of give us a quick overview in your mind of like where you see some of, you know, the TZD use, the sulfonylureas, the DPP-4 inhibitors, the theme that did come up a lot was like, if cost is a factor, then these are ones that you usually kind of reach into your toolbox for, or you at least tell, you know, other providers that this may be an option, but kind of maybe walk us through some of the high level summaries on where you would pick each one.
So for the next rung of drugs, Pio, being generic, is inexpensive. It treats the core defect of insulin resistance. It lowers triglycerides, raises HDL, has good A1C lowering. And as she had mentioned, the IRIS trial and in the proactive trial, it lowered strokes, even though it doesn't have that indication. I think on ACE guidelines, if you've had a stroke, Pio should be right up there. Mm-hmm. Also, there's some data that it may treat fatty liver. And it's not indicated for that, but there was good data for that, for fat re-trafficking, taking fat out of the liver and putting it where it should be in the fat cells. So that's Pio, and no hypoglycemia. Mm-hmm. However, there is some weight gain and edema. The next rung of drugs, colesevaram is generic. She touched a little bit about that, but it lowers LDL, mm-hmm. it lowers A1C. And also, since it's constipating, if someone has metformin diarrhea or GLP diarrhea, it might benefit the patient there. So sometimes it's used as an enhancement to lower LDL after a statin to get to LDL goal. Okay. It can raise triglycerides, though, and it's up to 6 pills a day or the drink that it's put in. The next rung is not generic. So DPP-4s are still very commonly used. They don't cause hypoglycemia. They're weight neutral. Unfortunately, they don't have cardiac benefit, but they're not harmful in terms of the heart. But if you have a thin type 2 where weight loss is not an issue, like a thin elderly type 2 whose A1C is somewhat high, and if they don't have cardiac issues, or renal issues, you could use a DPP-4 for lowering A1C, no hypoglycemia, and weight neutral. And so, you know, they're still very widely used. They're not yet generic, but soon to be generic. Unfortunately, they didn't have cardiac benefit. So that's where GLPs, you know, most of our peers use a GLP instead of a DPP-4. Mm-hmm. But if you don't need the weight loss and you don't need the cardiac benefit, DPP-4s are useful. And unlike a sulfonylurea, don't use hypoglycemia. Mm-hmm. And the thing we both had in common is we don't use sulfonylurea therapy if we can avoid it. But sometimes you're stuck because of cost and patient can't afford anything else.
Absolutely. And one thing that I thought was interesting to hear Dr. Dahl's perspective was, you know, the resetting of the circadian rhythm specifically for bromocriptine. I also didn't realize that there was some, you know, cardiovascular data, and she made some excellent points of why she, you know, reaches for that. It seems like insulin resistance, you know, but also if she's not looking for additional weight loss from a hypoglycemia standpoint. So, you know, it was great to kind of hear someone's been using it on the front lines to kind of understand their perspective and kind of where it fits into clinical practice. So thank you so much for joining us for this episode.
Thanks.